17, chapter 27. It's a narrative, it's a story, it's the account of history. And the Bible is all inspired by God, and it's there, as he said to Timothy, you know, all scripture is inspired, and it's good for us, and it's helpful, and it's teaching, it teaches us. So we'll read the story, and then we'll see. You may think of things as we go through. You may think, well, yeah, that means that, and that helps us in that way. This shows us about God and what he's like. You might be able to add, and that's good, to what I'm going to bring out. I want to bring two specific things out from the passage. So Acts chapter 27, and I'm going to read from the NLT, just to make it different this evening and helpful. It's just easier in terms of narrative. So, Acts 27. When the time came, we set sail for Italy. Paul and several other prisoners were placed in the custody of a Roman officer named Julius, a captain of the imperial regiment. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was also with us. The us is Luke as well as Paul. So you've got Aristarchus, Luke, and Paul. We left on a ship whose home port was Andromitium on the northwest coast of the province of Asia. It was scheduled to make several stops at ports along the coast of the province. The next day we docked at Sidon. Julius was very kind to Paul and let him go ashore to visit friends so they could provide for his needs. Putting out from sea to sea from there, we encountered strong headwinds that made it difficult to keep the ship on course. So we sailed north of Cyprus between the island and the mainland. Keeping to the open sea, we passed along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, landing at Myra in the province of Lycia. There the commanding officer found an Egyptian ship from Alexandria that was bound for Italy, and he put us on board. We had several days of slow sailing, and after great difficulty, we finally neared Cnidus. But the wind was against us, so we sailed across to Crete and along the sheltered coast of the island past the Cape of Salmone. We struggled along the coast with great difficulty and finally arrived at Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. We had lost a lot of time. The weather was becoming dangerous for sea travel because it was so late in the autumn. And Paul spoke to the ship's officers about it. Men, he said, I believe there is great trouble ahead if we go on. Shipwreck, loss of cargo, and danger to our lives as well. But the officer in charge of the prisoners listened more to the ship's captain and the owner than to Paul. And since Fair Havens was an exposed harbor, a poor place to spend the winter, most of the crew wanted to go to Phoenix, further up the coast, and spend the winter there. Phoenix was a good harbor and with only a southwest and northwest exposure. When a light wind began blowing from the south, the sailors thought that they could make it. So they pulled up the anchor and sailed close to the shore of Crete. But the weather changed abruptly, and a wind of typhoon strength called a northeaster burst across the land and blew us out to sea. The sailors couldn't turn the ship into the wind, so they gave up and let it run before the gale. We sailed along the sheltered side of the small island of Cauda, where with great difficulty we hoisted aboard the lifeboat being towed behind us. Then the sailors bound ropes around the hull of the ship to strengthen it. They were afraid of being driven across the sandbars of Cyatis off the African coast, so they lowered the sea anchor to slow the ship and were driven before the wind. The next day, as gale force winds continued to batter the ship, the crew began throwing the cargo overboard. The following day, they even took some of the ship's gear and threw it overboard. The terrible storm raged for many days, blotting out the sun and the stars until at last all hope was gone. No one had eaten for a long time. Finally, Paul called the crew together and said, "Men, you should have listened to me." Great last words, aren't they? "Men, you should have listened to me in the first place and not left Crete. You would have avoided all this damage and loss. But take courage. None of you will lose your lives, even though the ship will go down. For last night, an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, stood beside me. And he said, "Don't be afraid, Paul, for you will surely stand trial before Caesar. What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. So take courage, for I believe God, and it will be just as he said. But we will be shipwrecked on an island." About midnight on the 14th night of the storm, as we were being driven across the Sea of Adria, the sailors sensed land was near. They dropped a weighted line and found that the water was 120 feet deep. But a little later they measured again and found it to be only 90 feet deep. At this rate, they were afraid we would soon be driven against the rocks along the shore. So they threw out 4 anchors from the back of the ship and prayed for daylight. Then the sailors tried to abandon the ship, they lowered the lifeboat as though they were going to put out anchors from the front of the ship. But Paul said to the commanding officer and the soldiers, "You'll all die unless the sailors stay aboard." So the soldiers cut the ropes of the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just as day was dawning, Paul urged everyone to eat. "You have been so worried that you haven't touched food for 2 weeks," he said. "Please eat something now for your own good, for not a hair of your head will perish." Then he took some bread, gave thanks to God before all of them, and broke off a piece and ate it. Then everyone was encouraged and began to eat, all 276 of us who were on board. After eating, the crew lightened the ship further by throwing the cargo of wheat overboard. When morning dawned, they didn't recognize the coastline, but they saw a bay with a beach and wondered if they could get to shore by running the ship aground. So they cut off the anchors and left them in the sea. Then they lowered the rudders, raised the foresail, and headed toward shore. But they hit a shoal and ran the ship aground too soon. The bow of the ship stuck fast, while the stern was repeatedly smashed by the force of the waves and began to break apart. The soldiers wanted to kill the prisoners to make sure they didn't swim ashore and escape, but the commanding officer wanted to spare Paul, so he didn't let them carry out their plan. Then he ordered all who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land. The others held onto planks or debris from the broken ship, so everyone escaped safely ashore. The story goes on. They were on Malta, but that's as far as we'll read, us as far as we need to go. If you've been following along for the last, I don't know how long it is now, this last part of the story, you'll know that Paul was taken by the Jews, who threatened to lynch him in Jerusalem when he'd gone to deliver them the money offering. And he was rescued by the Roman soldiers. And he's gone through a series of trials. He's had a trial before the Sanhedrin. He managed to set them against each other by talking about the resurrection. So the Pharisees were kind of at loggerheads with the Sadducees. And so that kind of ended with a complete chaos. Then he went to stood trial before Felix, the Roman governor. And remember, Felix left him in prison for 2 years. We talked about divine confinements last time. You know, when God just leaves us somewhere, what's he doing in this time when nothing's happening? Talked about that. And then after Felix came Festus. And Festus immediately set up a trial for Paul. He couldn't find any fault with him. And then Festus' boss, King Agrippa, came to visit Festus. And Festus sort of talks to Agrippa. I don't think we read this passage, but Festus talks to Agrippa and to the king. And the king says, I'd like to listen to this guy. I'd like to hear a bit about him myself. And so Paul goes before Agrippa and makes his defense, sort of explains what's going on and what he's done. And Agrippa, again, like the rest of them, just thinks, this guy's done nothing wrong. This is a Jewish problem. This is nothing to do with us Romans. And he says to Festus, he said, look, if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, then he could have gone free. But you see, Paul has appealed to Caesar. When Festus had wanted to take the trial to Jerusalem, which was the hotbed of Jewish extremism, the people that wanted to kill Paul, Paul knew that that would be trouble, that he probably wouldn't get out of there alive. And so he said, I'm not going to Jerusalem. I'm making my appeal directly to Emperor Caesar, which was his right as a Roman citizen. And that is how he gets to be on the boat. So they're on this boat and he's on this journey with loads of other prisoners to get to Rome. Now, hopefully, somewhere here, just one picture to show you. I should have put it up as we were reading. That's the journey. So he starts down here at Jerusalem, up to Sidon. The wind was against them all the way. That's an interesting thing. There's Myra and Nidus. Fair Havens, the little place where Paul wanted to stay. Phoenix is just here, where they wanted to get to, but they never made it. So there's a little geographical fix for you. They wanted to stay they stopped over at Fair Havens. We read the story, didn't we? And it was late September, early October. The accepted wisdom was that you didn't do Mediterranean sailing after that time because of the winds. And so there was some thought that they'd stay at Fair Havens. However, Fair Havens was not a great place to spend the winter. And they knew that just up the coast was Phoenix. They said, we can just make 40 miles, we can get to Phoenix. It's a bigger place, it's got a harbour that's suitable for overwintering. That's the place to go to. And, of course, when the wind changed, Robin would know all about this kind of stuff. The wind changed, and he thought, this is a great day for sailing. So they think, we can do the 40 miles up the coast to Phoenix, no problem at all. And they start on their journey. And no sooner had they started out of the port from Fair Havens to get to Phoenix, this great gale, this northeaster, which we had in Wales last week, I am convinced of it, blew down upon them and blew them away from land. They never did make Phoenix, which was kind of what Paul had warned them would happen. But then why would you listen to a preacher when you've got a captain, you've got a boat full of mature, experienced sailors? Why are you going to listen to a preacher suddenly start saying about the weather? You're not going to, are you? But I think there is something that we can notice here about the way the people made their decision making. I think it's something for us as well. They decided not to stay at Fair Havens, despite the lovely name. They wanted to go to Phoenix. Why did they do it? There were two reasons that I could see. First of all, because it lacked the necessary protection. It lacked the safety. It was a small harbour. It was going to be exposed. If they were going to stay there all winter, it wasn't a great place to stay. It was exposed. And I think the other thing, being such a small place. Fair Havens was just a small kind of village place with a small port. So it was not going to have a lot of creature comfort. So you imagine these are sailors and they're going to stay there the whole winter. I think they probably thought, if we can get to Phoenix, we'll be safer. And there's some good hostelries up there. You know, we can go and drink and we can find some women and we can go and roll some dice or whatever they would want to do. It's a place for sailors to go to. So they made their decision on those bases, particularly the security. And then, of course, the circumstances seemed right. When the wind changed, they concluded, yeah, let's go. It's got to be the right thing for us to do. And when you think about it, that's very typical of how people make decisions in life, especially for people who aren't Christians. They're going to look at circumstance. They're going to look at what's better for them. They're going to look at the circumstances around them. They're going to make their decisions. Nothing intrinsically wrong in those things, are there? Nothing intrinsically wrong with them at all. We don't need to despise them. Even as Christians, God has given us minds. He's given us observations. He's given us experience. And, you know, we can use those things. They're good to use. However, And there is a however in this. As followers of Jesus, our overriding consideration needs to be bigger than does it seem right? Does it, is it going to make me feel better? Is it going to be more convenient? Is it going to be safe? And those kind of things. And say nothing wrong with those. But what as Christians is our overriding consideration in any decision that we make in life? Is it not what is going to help the kingdom? What's going to help me in my relationship with God? Our decision making should never be governed simply by comfort or circumstance. When our desire for security or enjoyment or comfort, if that impacts our devotion to Jesus and our availability for serving him, if it's going to tend to distract us, then those things which I've said they're okay, they stop being neutral and become hindrances. And we need to keep in our mind what is going to help me in my walk and my relationship with God. And I think however long we've been on the Christian pathway, and most of us have been going along as Christians for a while, we just need to keep these things in mind, don't we? I think guidance and knowing what to do is one of the hardest things. We talked a little bit about this at our life group last time. We talked about putting out fleeces and, you know, is it okay still to do that? Should we do it? I kind of said, well, there's nothing intrinsically wrong, but most of the time we've got the scriptures, the full scriptures to help us, and God's given us a brain and those kind of things. But the key thing is in our decision making, however we make the decision, it's is it going to help us spiritually? Is it going to bring us closer to God? Is it going to run the risk that our minds and our hearts and our devotions will be taken away? Because if there's one thing that Satan wants to do, it's to take us away from Jesus. He wants to fill us with other things. And bless God for the wonderful things that we have on earth, isn't it? You know, he's the giver of every good and perfect gift, Paul says. We shouldn't despise things. And sometimes there can be a thought that, as Christians, well, we shouldn't have good things, as if they're inherently wrong. There's nothing wrong with having nice things. There's nothing wrong with having a holiday, a nice house, nice clothes. Nothing wrong with having a nice meal. Nothing wrong with going camping or those kind of things. Except the Lord obviously didn't want us to go camping because he sent us home. It's if those things become more important than our walk with the Lord. You know where I'm coming from. I'm just flagging up the dangers here because we see it with these men and the way they made their decisions. So when we're trying to make a decision, when we're trying to know what to do, the question to ask is it going to help or hinder my walk with God? If I take this job, if I buy this house, is it going to help? What will be the implications of doing this? Is it going to help or hinder? Is it going to help me spiritually? Is it going to help the family of God spiritually? Is it going to make me more available for serving the Lord, for helping others? And what about the lost? We can never lose sight of the lost, those without Jesus. How's it going to help me work with others to be reaching the lost, which is the heart of God? Those are the kind of things we need to keep in mind. So that's decision making. That's number one situation here. Back to Paul now. The folly of them chancing their arm and decision to go proved seriously wrong, didn't it? Because they leave the safety of the harbour and the wind changes and they get driven across the Mediterranean. It's a serious storm. I find it interesting. These are experienced sailors and they get to the point of utter despair. They just think that everything has gone. Then they're not going to come out from this alive. They didn't eat for 14 days. You know, what a stupid thing that is. You know, if you're going to die, at least die with your belly full. Yes. But they're so scared they can't even eat. And 14 days of being filled with dread. No idea when the end would come. Waiting, I imagine, every moment for that fatal that fateful crack of timber against rock, or for the jolt of the boat as it goes against a sandbank. and judders to a halt. They throw everything possible overboard to make it lighter, to make it sit light, higher in the water so they can get closer to the land. Even Paul, it seems, had given up hope. When you look at verse 20, it says the terrible storm lasted, raged for many days, blotting out the sun and the stars until the last of hope was gone. That was Luke writing that. He doesn't say it was just the sailors. It is as if Luke and Paul and Aristarchus had also given up hope. All of which begs the question, why is it that given that Paul was in the service of God, why is it that God allowed them to come into this perilous situation and ultimately to shipwreck? And I think that's a major, major question that many Christians have. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? We could frame it like that. Why is it that God allows those things to happen to us? And I think all of us, in one way or another, have those things. Why? Where is God? Why isn't he doing something? Well, something to notice before I give you one little answer, and I'm not going to try and do an exhaustive answer on that. I'm going to give you one thing that I think we see in the text here. But one thing to notice in all of this is that even though they were afraid, even though they'd given up hope for life, in verses 23 to 24 to 25, we find that God was with him. And God spoke to him. God knew exactly what was going on. He knew exactly what was happening to Paul. He knew where Paul was. And crucially, he knew how Paul was feeling. Read it. That night, an angel of the Lord, to whom I belong, before whom I serve, stood beside me. And he said, "Don't be afraid, Paul." Why would he say, "Don't be afraid," if Paul wasn't afraid? Paul was scared. There was something not right here, he's thinking. So the message came, "Don't be afraid, for you will surely stand trial before Caesar. What's more, God in his goodness has granted safety to everyone sailing with you. So take courage," he says, "for I believe God and it will be just as he has said." You got this message from God who knew what it was like. Don't be afraid. God knew that Paul was scared. You'll get out of this situation alive. The words of God's promise of protection. I'm watching over you. You're not going to perish. Not only am I going to be with you, you're not going to die. This isn't going to end in the calamity that you think it is. And if God knew Paul's circumstances, then we can be equally sure that he knows our circumstances. And he knows the circumstance of every one of his children. These words, these promises from the Lord encouraged Paul's faith. His fear went, and he stood in the midst of the storm. In the midst of the storm, notice that. It wasn't when the storm ended. It was in the storm. He called the people around him, and he's able to encourage other people. And that's the triumph of faith. The triumph of faith is being able to stand in the storm and hold your nerve when all around is losing theirs. This is what it means to truly believe God's word and promises. That's what it does for us, that we hold on and we have hope. It doesn't mean that we're singing from the chandeliers, we're walking around with Cheshire Cat grins. It doesn't mean we have to do that. But it does mean that we trust God. We might not know what God is going to do. We might not have the vision that Paul had here. But we do have his promises, don't we? Written in the scriptures, "I will be with you always, even until the end of the age. Do not fear, I am with you. Do not despair, I am with you." Over and over and over again. I think somebody calculated, didn't they? 365 times the command, "Do not be afraid," comes up. I don't know who did that sum, but that's what somebody I've heard has said that. 365, one for every day. "Do not be afraid," or words of that ilk. You know, that's the promise of God. He's with us in the midst of the trials. But that doesn't answer the question, why, does it? Why does God allow those trials? Why does he allow the shipwrecks to come upon us when we may, like Paul, be in the middle of doing his will? Well, part of the answer is found for Paul in something that he had written earlier to the Christians in Rome. He had written a letter to the Christians living in this city. We have it as the letter to the Romans in our Bibles. And in chapter 1, verse 13, he'd written that 2 years before this voyage. In chapter 1 and verse 13, he said that he had wanted to visit them many times, but had been prevented. I wanted to visit you many times, but I've been prevented. And even now he's on his way there, and it seems that events are conspiring to try, if they can, to stop him. What's going on? Well, something or someone was conspiring against this visit to Rome. And I believe that Paul had Satan in his mind when he said, I'm being prevented. You see, Rome was the headquarters of Satan's realm on earth at that time. Rome was the center of Roman government that was working increasingly against the Christians. Rome was the center of all that was bad. It was there that Satan kind of had his throne. It would stand to reason then, wouldn't it, that he would do everything he could. He'd bring all his powers to bear to stop this great apostle getting to Satan's home territory and disturbing the nest and bringing good news of Jesus right into the heart of the enemy mothership. And so he goes to thwart Paul's effort, even to the degree of bringing a shipwreck. And we shouldn't rule that out in our lives also. But sometimes in our lives, Satan wants to stop us. He wants to thwart us. I'm not saying it's the same, it's the case every time. There's lots of reasons why things, but one of them is we have a spiritual enemy and we can't take him lightly. And he wants to drive us away from God. He wants to get us to reject our faith in God. He wants us to become discouraged and ineffective. And he will use any means possible. He's not all-powerful. God is over him. But in this world, while we live here, he does have some influence. And he will bring bad things to pass. But even so, in the midst of that, what we see is that God overruled all of this for good. And so even in our lives when things happen, you know, Romans 8:28, we've got to keep that in mind. It's a great verse, isn't it? Romans, who can tell me what Romans 8:28 says? Yeah. All things work together for good to those that love God and called according to his purpose. All things, in all things, God works together for our good. Hold on to that. In all things. The nice things, the bad things, the things we wish that weren't happening. God was overruling in Paul's situation. Those sailing with Paul got to see. You know, he stood up, he'd had the guts to stand up and say, God has said this. Can you imagine if God hadn't have come through with that? But he did, didn't he? He came through. He said, no one's going to die. No one died. He said there's going to be a shipwreck. There was a shipwreck, but no one died. They were all kept safe. It was exactly as God said. Don't you think that would have had an impact on the people on the boat? And then he gets to Malta, and Paul is able to preach on Malta, and they have a little campfire, and something else happened, if I'm remembering it right. I think that's where the snake came out of the wood and latched itself onto Paul's hand, and he shook it off, and they're waiting for him to die, and he doesn't. You know, another great opportunity for Paul to witness to the power and the grace of God. So God was in it and God was overruling for good. But we have to admit, sometimes we can't see what those good things are. And this is where it gets hard, isn't it? It's where we have to avoid giving trite answers. Yes, God works together for good in all things. We hold on to that. We know it. But sometimes we can't see it. Just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. Faith is, I'm going to believe God even though I can't see it. That's not blind faith, because we know from history, we know from our own experiences that that's the case, don't we? When we look back, we can see what God has done. So it's not blind faith. But faith holds on to that promise of God. But sometimes we're in a situation and we have no idea why these things are happening. And my mind went this afternoon when I was looking at this and thinking about it to Job in the Old Testament. Yours might have gone there already. Thinking of Job in the Old Testament, poor bloke. He lost everything almost overnight. He didn't have a clue what was going on. Now we do, don't we? We know the story. God in heaven, Satan comes to him and, where have you been? Oh, I've been looking around. And have you considered my servant Job? Oh, he'll curse you if you take away this. And, you know, he's only in it. He only loves you because of what he gets out of you. All right, go and test him. But don't do this. Whatever it was. Because Satan went and did his worst. As much as he could do. As much as he was given permission. Took his family away. Took his possessions. Lost everything. Job didn't know what it was. But what was going on was there was this heavenly battle going on. The honor of God was at stake, you see. God had entrusted to Job that Job would be true to him. Imagine if Job had failed. Sometimes in our lives and the lives of others, you know, we might not know that there's a heavenly battle going on, that God's honor might be at stake in the heavenly realms, and we can't see it. That's why it's so important that we're honorable to God. And we honor him and respect him. Poor old Job had these so-called friends who came and tried to give their explanations of what had happened. Well, you must have done something to deserve it. And, you know, he said, I haven't. They exposed Job's pride, and he had to, you know, God had to say to him in the end, you know, you think you know so much. And actually, were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Were you there? Oh, Job, you know so much, surely. That was a slightly different. Job learned through this, and he was humbled by it. He came out a better person. Sometimes we don't necessarily know. In the heat of it, we don't know. But we hold on to the promises of God. And what we see in this situation, that it turned out for good in Paul's life. And so it will be with us. It will either turn around for our good in this life, or it will be for the glory of God in this life. And we might not even see that. That's why it's so important that we do our very best to honor him in our thoughts, in our actions, in our reactions. In the situations that maybe we find ourselves in, and some of you are in pretty trying circumstances right now, or you may know and you may be with and you may be helping, trying to help other people, other Christians. You know, this is the message. Take it to them. Share it with them. Share, if you like, if you found some benefit in this, share what I've shared this evening. Go back to the promises of God, his faithfulness and his kindness and his control over all things. We don't necessarily know, but what we see is that he overrules in all things. And so that brings us to the place where we remember our Lord Jesus. Because supremely, of course, when we talk of Job, we think of Jesus, who knew what was going on, didn't he? Jesus knew what was going on, but it was hard for him. You know, when he was in the garden, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And he pleaded with him, and he was sweating. I think the old authorized version says he was sweating, as it were, great drops of blood. Extreme stress going on. It wasn't easy to go to the point of the cross. It was hard, yet for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame. We have the joy that's set before us. So let's seek to honor God in the way that Job did, in the way that Jesus did. And as we draw to conclusion tonight,